From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. And we are very thankful for you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
I would like to see all Americans have access to the same healthcare rights. But beyond that public policy goal, my goals really are quite simple, and they mostly do boil down to my family and friends.
She worried the seizures she was having would leave her incapable of making her own decision if she waited too long.
There's a huge conversation happening right now on both sides of the story.
5 states allow doctors to write prescriptions to help patients end their lives. 7 more have recently considered so-called death with dignity laws.
Last weekend, a leading activist for the right of terminally ill patients to end their own lives acted on her convictions. 29-year-old Brittany Maynard, living with an incurable brain tumor, had moved to Oregon to have access to that state's right to die laws. On this week's show, we'll look at the history and religious implications of this terribly sensitive and personal issue with Religion News Service's Kathy Lynn Grossman. I'll also talk with the Reverend Tim Kutzmark, a pastor in the Unitarian Universalist Association, the only denomination which has explicitly expressed its support for the right to die in specific cases. But first,
Republicans were not elected to govern. It is to stop Barack Obama. It is to stop the Democrat Party.
The president continues to act on his own. He is going to poison the well. When you play with matches, you take the risk of burning yourself.
The voters gave the Republican Party a mandate to do what is necessary to undo, obstruct, and oppose all of Obama's efforts.
So the predictions were wrong. Pundits predicted that Democrats would do badly overall this past Tuesday. Instead, it turns out that the Democrats did abysmally badly overall. When I spoke to Greg LaBelle on this program last week, we acknowledged that it would probably take some time to see what the final result would be in several important races, and we agreed that he'd be back once some definitive analysis was possible. As it turns out, it didn't take all that long, so I'm able to welcome Greg back to State of Belief Radio a lot sooner than expected. Greg, thanks for being here with us again.
I just want to say it takes a lot of courage to come back just a week after predictions. Most people who do these things sort of vanish for 6 weeks so that everyone will have forgotten what they said by the time they have to talk about them again. So,
Okay. Well, I mean, forgiveness has to be built into this whole system. Yeah. There's no question.
Yeah.
A week ago at this time, it was conventional wisdom that the GOP would do very well this past Tuesday. Do you know anyone who was predicting the party's candidates would do this well?
No. Nobody was. This was as much of a shock to Republican-leaning pundits and Republican organizers as it was to anybody. And some races in particular were real surprises.
Uh-huh. What race or two stood out for you as the biggest shockers?
The Virginia Senate race. It looked for a while like Mark Warner might actually lose that seat. And Virginia was not on anybody's radar, which may be what actually helped Gillespie sort of get where he was. And Virginia's become an interesting state. You know, they threw Eric Cantor out of office during the primaries. And now almost sent Mark Warner home mm-hmm. in the general election. So it's unclear exactly what's going on there. But that was a real, real surprise. No one thought that was going to be that close.
The one thing that everybody kept saying leading up to the election was that people are mad.
Mm.
The exit polls were showing people are really fed up with D.C. Was it that, or was there some intangible there that we didn't anticipate?
The voters in general are disgusted. They are absolutely disgusted across the board. You add to the fact that this is, again, this is the 6th year of an administration that does come into play. The president took some hits for saying that on Election Day. But in fact, it is true. There's a sense of being sort of tired of the same old story by the sixth year of a presidency. So there was that part of it, too. With Virginia, it was just the opportunity that no one was paying attention that gave Gillespie the opportunity to build this this campaign up to that point. To some extent, I think Senator Warner was caught sleeping. So I think the combination of those three things, voter disgust, a real turning away from the president. I think maybe – I guess if there's a fourth issue, it's turnout. What we saw was a significant drop in turnout, as we did in 2010, particularly among young people and minorities. And in Virginia, that's significant.
Another big surprise or not?
I guess the closeness of the race in New Hampshire, it was registering close, but I thought, and I think a number of people thought, that there was going to be a wider space between the two candidates there. The third is probably Georgia, that it doesn't have to go to a runoff, that that was so clear. And I'm going to give you a fourth, and that's Kentucky. I don't think they had shut all the machines off in Kentucky before they had declared that Mitch McConnell was the winner there. That was stunning.
As you approach looking at the election from an academic perspective, since you live in academia now, how will your students and how will you and your colleagues as professors explain how poorly the Democrats did?
To a large extent, this does come down to message. And the Republican candidates had a simpler, easier standard message. A vote for X is a vote for Obama. And they showed great message discipline through the entire process of sticking with that. We didn't have anyone talking about the benefits of rape or whatever else, whatever other crazy stuff that we have seen in the past out of some Republican candidates. So there was great message discipline there. It was a harder message for Democrats to carry because they had different messages. They tried to localize the election. So in each case, it was about what was going on in their states. I think some Democrats may have gone too far in trying to distance themselves from Obama. And there have been some recriminations since the election along that line. Alison Lundgren Grimes refused to say who she voted for, even though she was a delegate to the Democratic convention. That put questions to her authenticity and her willingness to sort of level. And so there were problems that came along with that, I think, as well.
I suppose the emotion that gripped me the most as I kept thinking back through this whole process was the emotion of disgust that candidates who identify themselves as Democrats distance themselves from the leader of Democrats in the nation who sits in the White House. And I got to thinking, Greg, it's not just about Democrats. The same thing happened to George W. Bush when he was having a hard time and Republicans pulled away from him and campaigned without him. And in both instances, the parties lost.
Yeah.
And it makes me think that politicians who are going to get in campaigns need to remember that the electorate seems to be displeased with Democrats' light and Republicans' light. They want to know, who are you? Are you the real thing? And then I can make a decision. But don't tell me you're a Democrat and then you don't act like one, or that you're a Republican don't act like one.
Right. And that's exactly the message that Ted Cruz is carrying to the Republican Party as now we've turned the page to 2016.
Oh, my goodness. That's the only thing I've ever done that was like Ted Cruz.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's Cruz's message now to the Republican Party. No more McCains, no more Romneys. We need someone, maybe me, who will sort of stand up for Republicans stand for. It's hard to gin up excitement in the base when you're not talking about the things the base cares about. But the other interesting thing, I look at some of the exit polls. 60% of the people who answered exit polls said that health care was a significant issue for them. 60% of those people who cited health care as an important issue voted for the Democrat. So we have this sense that when people are talking about health care reform, they are opposed to it. But in fact, it's exactly the opposite. That number jumped out at me probably more than anything else from the exit polls. So if Democrats are refusing to talk about health care reform and 60% of people who vote Democrat think it's important, there's something that's not connected. we get to the discussion of authenticity, and I think that's where you're going, and I think it's true. There is an authenticity gap here.
Yeah. You have seen candidates both in times of success and in times of difficulty. You've seen them up close. What do you think President Obama's feeling like today?
Well, there's no question that losses like this smart. And I think it's not just the president, but the people around him. This is a painful bucket of cold water in the face. For at least a few minutes, we can't delude ourselves into thinking we are more popular than we actually are. It's a bracing experience at best. But I think what happens very quickly is that then organizations move to the question of what is the light that we want to put this into? And politicians are very good at sort of separating the sort of personal from the message, from the professional. You have to be a successful politician in American politics. So I think probably fairly quickly that gets – you sort of vent that and then that gets set aside. And then the question becomes, okay, how do we present this? And I think the president and the people around him are looking at this saying, we have to stand up for what we think is important and we have to offer – an olive branch. So it's a little bit of both. And I think when you listen to Mitch McConnell's speech last night, there was a little bit of both in that too. He said, just because there are two parties doesn't mean we always have to be fighting, but here are all the things we want. In some respects, I think this turn of the page makes it a little bit easier for the president to take on some of these key issues like immigration reform and so on and so forth, because he had to worry for the last year about what the impact would be on various Democratic Senate candidates. Mm-hmm. If he moved out on some of these issues. That's off his back now.
Right.
He's got a little bit more room to move. Now, of course, we are now in the 2016 presidential race. So there is some of that, but it's not as immediate and it's not as varied. So so to some extent, this frees him up a little bit.
Yeah. President Bill Clinton has been seen as a powerful elder statesman within the party. But among the candidates that he and potential presidential candidate Hillary Clinton worked to elect, Tuesday's results were abysmal for them as well. How do you see what happened in this 2014 election affecting 2016 and Hillary Clinton?
First of all, you're right, and I think it has to particularly hurt when you look at Arkansas losing the Senate seat and the governorship is now moving to the Republicans. And so that's going to be particularly difficult for the Clintons. This is that point in time where they're sort of sitting down and figuring out, okay, what does this mean for us? What does this mean for a Clinton candidacy in 2016? Beyond that, it's difficult to say exactly what this means in their context, because this was – I almost hate to use this term because it's overused, but it really was – there was a wave here. And I think it's difficult to hold – any of the surrogates who are out there directly responsible. In fact, I think Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's work on behalf of candidates, successful or not, buys them goodwill, as everyone pretty much assumes she will move into the nomination process.
Yeah. What were the biggest mistakes the Democrats made?
I think that Tom Udall's race in Colorado is a good example. I think making some assumptions, trying to narrow what the race was about. Tom Udall tried to make that race in Colorado about women's reproductive issues, and it was a mistake. We're in a place in American politics right now, in American society right now, where people are worried about a lot of things, and trying to build the race around one particular issue was a mistake, and I suspect we saw that in some other places as well. Again, it's really difficult to localize some of these races in the face of so many national challenges. Mm-hmm. I don't know if many of them could have done much better. I do know, and I think this is interesting, because Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire, who's the only Democrat in a race that was tight, who managed to win, I think she took advantage of her longstanding relationship with the voters. And I think other candidates could have done this too. Her message boiled down in the last few weeks in that race to, you know me. Mm-hmm. Three-term governor, finishing her first term in the Senate, spent most of her adult life in the state, busy in the state in politics and policy. This came down to the message of you know me, particularly powerful because she's running against a guy who just happened to move into the state last year. Although I do think it's a powerful message, and I think that other candidates might have been smart to pick up some variation on that message.
What do Republicans need to do when they take control of the Senate as well as the House?
Something, anything. And this is going to be the challenge. The Republicans really have, I think, two mandates. The moderate Republicans and independents, and independents did break fairly quite clearly for Republicans in these races, and that's important. So you've got these independents and moderate Republicans out there who are looking for somebody to do something, to start tackling these problems and take them on. And that is probably Mitch McConnell's inclination, just as it is really John Boehner's inclination as an individual. Mm-hmm. But the other mandate is from the base that says, we got to take on the president. We've got to start having these votes on eliminating Obamacare. We've got to do the same thing on immigration. We have to do the same thing on regulation, various types of government regulation. We've got to start kicking some butt now. Mm-hmm. We hold both houses. And again, Ted Cruz is probably going to be the guy who's sort of leading that in the Senate. So the new majority leader has to figure out a way to somehow satisfy both of these groups, both of these mandates. And we've seen how much trouble John Boehner has had with that. Mm-hmm. He's been humiliated on more than one occasion by his own caucus in the House. And I suspect, unless McConnell has some skills that we haven't yet seen, he's going to have a similar situation.
What's the one piece of advice that you have for Democrats going forward?
sorry. Democrats have an opportunity now to begin to coalesce. 2016 is going to be a very different race. It's not only going to be a very different race because it'd be a presidential year, but it looks like, and aside from talking about the strengths and weaknesses of the likely nominee, it looks like the Democratic Party will not be doing battle in spite of these losses over the soul of the Democratic Party. There will be a little of that. But it's not going to be what we usually see in these postmortems of elections. I think there is a general consensus here, and I think that the Democrats will – and partly that's because they have a very visible and sort of obvious nominee. There will be a sort of a gathering of the Klan that makes it a little bit easier for them to sort of deal with this post-trouncing period. So I think that's sort of where we will see the Democratic Party leadership heading.
You know, voters seem to have – great confidence in the consequences of their votes, the consequences of an election, as it should be. I remember saying on the show when President Obama was first elected to office that I anticipated some real fall off of excitement about politics because there were going to be a lot of people disappointed in what happened.
Yes.
I think that the Republicans are set up for a similar situation because there was so much passion and a lot of the passion, angry passion, about the gridlock in Washington. Isn't the gridlock going to continue?
Yes. There are those two mandates that don't fit together. Yeah. And so the Republicans have to figure out how to keep those two very different groups happy. You know, there's gridlock between Democrats and Republicans, but there's also we have seen gridlock within the Republican Party in the House side. Yeah. And I think that's what we have the potential of seeing, particularly if Ted Cruz decides to make this the jumping off point for a presidential bid. Mm-hmm. He's going to be challenging his own majority leader. And I don't think Ted Cruz has any difficulty taking that on at all. I think he actually will enjoy it immensely.
Yeah. Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University and head of the Semester in Washington program. Greg, 2 weeks in a row, you've taken time out of a very busy schedule to lend your expertise to this important conversation. I really do appreciate it. I know our listeners do as well. Whatever the situation in the nation, it's good to talk with you about it. I always come away having learned something and have insights that I want to ponder. Thank you for making that possible, and we'll do it again soon.
Well, it really is important, and the fact that you are continuing to talk about this and is a real service. Thank you.
Last weekend, a leading advocate of the right to die for terminally ill patients, 29-year-old Brittany Maynard, chose to end her own life. Increasingly affected by an incurable brain tumor, She died surrounded by her family, which moved to Oregon with her so they could be together in a state that permits the right to die. A valuable overview of the way different religious denominations approach this issue in terms of ethics and morality appeared this week from Religion News Service. The writer is Kathy Lynn Grossman, and I am so happy to have her join us now on State of Belief Radio. Kathy, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oregon is a state that grants a right to die in specific circumstances. If you would summarize what some of those circumstances are.
Generally, somebody has to be certified by maybe two physicians that they have a condition for which there is no treatment, that they are likely to die in the next 6 months, and that they are not depressed or making this decision under duress, that they are freely choosing this decision. And then they can get a prescription for lethal drugs. And the reason it's called physician-assisted dying is that the physician assists by evaluating and writing a prescription. They don't have to participate in this. No doctor is required to do this. But when it comes time to actually take that prescription, the person has to be still well enough to physically take the drugs without assistance. They have to be able to pick it up and swallow it. And for Brittany Maynard, that was a question. She was concerned about whether she would become too debilitated to actually exercise that right.
And if that had been the case, no member of her family could have done that. Isn't that right?
Not legally.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Kathy, what other states recognize a terminally ill patient's prerogative to end their own life?
Well, it's a total of five states now: Washington State, Vermont, Montana, and New Mexico.
Has there been any significant change in the status of this issue?
I think that it rises and falls in public attention. I think that when Brittany Maynard contacted Compassionate Choices, which is the group that is one of the prime advocacy groups for this law, along with Death with Dignity, she really gave that attention a shot in the arm because she represented young people. People tend to think that this is something that's not about them, that they don't need to pay attention to this issue unless they have an elderly parent or friend or relative who may be sick and dying. But Brittany Maynard's involvement is a very visual, immediate sense, hey, this is about everybody.
How overtly have the religious denominations in the United States taken a position on the right to die?
Most major denominations are adamantly opposed to physician-assisted dying. As one evangelical spokesperson, Joni Erickson Tata, put it, this is God alone makes the decision about the day that you die. There are some religions that don't have a specific teaching on this. The National Baptist Convention, the Presbyterian Church, the United Church of Christ, this is a matter that they're still studying. They're debating this. But certainly the Catholic Church is opposed. The Southern Baptist Convention is opposed. The United Methodist Church is opposed. Lutheran churches are opposed. So the major denominations of Mormons are opposed. The biggest denominations that represent the most of Americans formally oppose this. The question becomes, of course, how often do people know or heed the teachings of their denomination?
Right. And I know this is somewhat of a guess, but what are the circumstances in which the ending of one's life is permitted when there is a church that does not condemn it?
First of all, I think no religious group believes in prolonging dying. St. John Paul II did not have artificial food and hydration in his last days. He declined that treatment. You can withhold or withdraw treatment if you believe that it is of no benefit. You're never going to be better. You can say, look, I don't want this anymore. You can spell it out in your advance directives. You can have your healthcare surrogate know that if you can't speak for yourself, you want them to decline life support things like the ventilator or feeding tubes. The question comes where, first of all, people don't have directives, and only one in three Americans have forget writing it down, have even had a discussion with their loved ones about what they want for their end of days. Their relatives are left to wonder, what is the right thing to do? What did my loved one want us to do?
I was thinking, when you mentioned the death of the Pope, what's the consequence of when a person shuts off all of the procedures to try to keep the person alive, even if they're declining in health? Is the church understanding and forgiving of that, or are they as adamant about that shouldn't be done as they are about the right to life itself?
I think a lot of times it depends on where you land, which bishops the hospital is, is dealing with. I believe that Catholic hospital systems have to honor your directives.
I see.
If you come in with a directive that says, I do not want this treatment, you may have to stand toe-to-toe with the ethicist or the priest to enforce it, or your loved ones may have to do that for you. But I think that their fundamental stance, however, is that providing these things is ordinary care, not extraordinary care. And people are not morally obligated to provide extraordinary care, to do things for people that are pointless and they're not going to cure them. But the Catholic Church believes, as do several other religions, that it is a privilege to care for someone. And that at some spiritual level, these people appreciate knowing that they will always be cared for.
Kathy, you've been reporting on religion for a long time, and for many of us, you've been someone to whom we look with great respect. What else should our listeners know about this very sensitive and intensely personal issue?
I would say that in conversations, you need to pay attention carefully to the vocabulary. If somebody refers to this as physician-assisted suicide, there's a reason that they chose the word suicide. Generally, it has to do with an agenda. They are opposed to it, and they are calling up the term suicide because suicide brings with it the baggage of people who would not be dying otherwise. I don't view this as suicide in the case of Brittany Maynard because she is dying. She doesn't. It's not like she had a choice, live, die. She was going to die. The question was how and when, not whether. But it's not just whether they say suicide or precision-assisted dying. It's also how they talk about the word suffering. A rabbi told me once that pain is physical, suffering is psychological. It's how you respond to pain. It's what you think about and how you feel about the situation that you're in. This rabbi told me, he said, most people suffer at the hands of their friends and loved ones, not at the hands of their disease, because there's disagreement over what to do. So even when you're using the same terms, it doesn't necessarily mean you're saying and meaning the same things. You want to clarify your terms with people when you're talking with them. But the most important thing that I would like people to take away is whatever it is you want, whatever it is you believe, talk to your loved ones about it. Don't prolong the agony by leaving them doubting whether they had done what you had wished.
Kathy Lynn Grossman is an award-winning journalist who is a senior national correspondent at Religion News Service. Prior to joining RNS, Kathy was at USA Today for over two decades, where she created the Religion and Ethics Beat. And I express great thanks for what you've said to our listeners and for you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Call me anytime.
As we reach deeper into both the ethical and the personal aspects of the right of terminally ill patients to what advocates term death with dignity, I'm pleased to be able to welcome the Reverend Tim Kutzmark to State of Belief Radio. The Reverend Kutzmark is a longtime pastor in the Unitarian Universalist Association, and he's confronted the issue of end-of-life decisions for persons with incurable conditions as part of his ministry in the only denomination in this country that has overtly expressed support for the right to end one's life under specific circumstances. Tim, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure and honor to be with you.
Your own personal stand on this position has changed over the years. Would you summarize what you once believed and what led to a change in those beliefs?
I can remember when I was in seminary at Harvard Divinity School, one of the first courses I took was an ethics class. And one of the issues that we debated and had to write a paper on was the idea of death with dignity, or the opportunity to hasten one's death if you were terminally ill. And at the time, I argued quite strongly against it. I think at that time I felt that allowing the natural course of one's life to play itself out was the proper, the spiritual, the more elevated thing to do, to trust that you would be able to bear all that would happen, that one's own faith would be strong enough to carry through no matter how much pain, discomfort, or extended dying process there would be. And it really felt to me to be contrary to what at the time I would have said was God's will, and that as human beings, the protection of life was one of the fundamental building blocks of a civilized society, and to take a life knowingly would be the first chip in that foundation. Mm-hmm. What changed for me was, part of it was my ministry with families in my congregations, and part of it was really a personal experience, and I'd love to be able to tell you the personal experience.
I'd love to hear it, because I was going to ask you what really was central in you changing your heart, and that would help.
I was mentored when I was much younger and had come to the Boston area by a really remarkable college professor by the name of Arthur Friedman, who was a professor of Shakespeare, an intellectual, a passionate man of words. He was also the theater critic for one of the major papers here in the Boston area, and was just a really generous, kind, giving individual, and was really a father figure to me. And we had a really wonderful friendship as well. And I remember several years into our friendship, and this was a man who was never at a loss for words, and I saw him and he looked ashen, and I said, you know, what's the matter? And he just handed me this piece of paper that said Parkinson's disease, and then proceeded to tell what Parkinson's disease was. And my friend Arthur lived for 15 years with Parkinson's disease, which is a horrible degenerative illness. In the early years, he was able to continue to teach and still live a vibrant life. But slowly, everything that gave his life meaning was slipped away. He had to stop teaching. He got to a point where his memory was befuddled as his body slowly stopped functioning. And he was so unhappy because he knew what awaited him, a really horrific death. And when the time came where he could no longer swallow, because you basically lose control of muscles, he made the decision to stop eating and drinking, and that way he could hasten his own death naturally. But he waited, I would say, for probably 3 miserable years before he could no longer swallow. And he would have liked to have hastened his death long before that. And to allow oneself to starve and dehydrate is a really horrific experience to undergo and to watch. And I watched his life wither away to a point where he was basically curled in the fetal position in a bed, just waiting and waiting for his body to stop working because he was no longer drinking any water. And it was cruel. And this illness took a vibrant, contributing, life-filled individual, and it literally reduced him to a shell of a human being. And he did not have the option, when things got so bad, to say, it's time for a graceful and dignified exit. And so really watching that experience was the key thing that caused me to realize that not all deaths are pretty, not all deaths are painless. And I've been with congregants in hospice, and I'm a huge fan of hospice, and they do extraordinary work, but the reality is medication cannot relieve the pain for all people. And I've been in the hospice with congregants, you know, with advanced cancer, that when the nurses try to move their bodies because of bed sores, bones break, they would scream in agony, and there's nothing that any medication could do to prevent that kind of, I would say, inhumane pain.
Yeah. Tim, I, as you described that so vividly and what it did to bring about a change of mind and heart in you, I was just sitting here thinking, I'm a pastor myself, and I've never understood how people who really do compassionate ministry can live with much dogma except the dogma of compassion and sensitivity and care. At the same time, you and I both hear these ethical arguments on this issue that are set before us with passion and with great conviction. I'm curious as to how you talk about those important ethical arguments and how you counter them.
You know, I'm thinking back to an instance where I testified at the Massachusetts State House before a panel of legislators. Some were quite vehemently opposed to the idea of death with dignity. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think it comes down to the safeguards that you put around the possibility of hastening one's own death, that it's a very limited criteria that are permitted this right, and it's carefully regulated. There are multiple physicians who have to be sure that this person's life is terminal and will be ending in the very near future. It's not something that should be taken lightly. At the same time, it is something that for a very small few who might choose to do this, I believe with those safeguards around, folks should have the right to meet death in the manner that is real and authentic for them.
Tim, you live and work in Massachusetts. What's the status of the Death with Dignity movement there?
Well, we lost 2 years ago the ballot initiative, and it was interesting because when the campaign began, the majority was in favor of Death with Dignity. Unfortunately, the funding came from folks who were against it. You know, the Catholic Church was a primary funder, and the TV and radio was flooded with advertisements that, quite frankly, were distorted and spoke some real untruth and terrified people. Mm-hmm. And so we did end up losing. I know that we're working in the State House to try to bring it before the legislature. Compassion and Choices, which is one of the national advocacy groups, is very active here in Massachusetts and has some extraordinary leadership. And for all of us, our fingers are crossed that that sometime in the near future that this is going to happen. And I think, you know, Massachusetts being, you know, its reputation for being a fairly liberal state, it's going to happen. It's just going to be a matter of time.
Is the Unitarian Universalist Association taking an active role on this issue?
Back in 1988, which is certainly a long time ago, the denomination took a stand in support of Death with Dignity. It has not been something that has been a major initiative in terms of the Unitarian Universalist Association, although certainly ministers and congregations have become involved in the issue. So it's not a denominational effort, but it's much more on the congregational level. And I might add, it was interesting 2 years ago because I preached and had forums for the congregation here. And, you know, within our congregation, not everyone was supportive of it. And I would say that most people were confused and unsure. And there needed to be a lot of conversation, a lot of spaciousness for people to talk about the fears and the concern of a slippery slope that this would lead to, you know, other forms of sanctioned killing. So even within our denomination and within our congregations, not everyone is 100% behind it.
And I've been listening carefully to what you've said and how you've said it, and you made very clear that this is not a choice for all people, probably, but it is a choice for a select number of people. I'm wondering, when you watch what happened this week with Brittany Maynard's story, you maybe have seen her moving videos.
Yeah.
Is there still any part of you that struggles with this?
You know, I don't, because I have seen what I would call good deaths, where mm-hmm. there's peace and comfort involved, and I have witnessed really horrific deaths. And for someone facing that possibility of a horrific death, knowing there is the possibility to have their life end a different way gives comfort, and I'll tell you, gives people strength. Mm-hmm. I've been with congregants who have made the choice to explore the option, have learned how to get the kinds of medication they need that they could use in case they ultimately chose mm-hmm. to hasten their life, and none of them have, mm-hmm. but there also was an incredible peace that came from knowing they could choose to be in control of the process. Mm-hmm. And so I don't hesitate anymore. To me, it's life is sacred, and I think we profane the sacredness of life by forcing people mm-hmm. to suffer.
I'm sure that some people listening to this radio broadcast are saying, I want to know more about this. Are there resources available for patients and families that want to understand more about this?
Absolutely. The organization that I would direct folks to is Compassion and Choices. You can Google that. They do great education. They present the materials in a very accessible way. And their name says it, Compassion mm-hmm. and Choices. They're mm-hmm. offering choice, but it's done with great love and humanity.
The Reverend Tim Kutzmark is pastor of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Reading, Massachusetts. He has served as chaplain at Hasbro Children's Hospital in Rhode Island, and he is the past chaplain at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Massachusetts General Hospital. Tim, this is a difficult subject, and I want to thank you for the sensitivity and the honesty that you've brought to this discussion. You've helped a lot of people.
I thank you for having me and creating the space to have this kind of a conversation.
Now, before we go, if you're anything like me, you're still processing the ramifications of this past week's midterm election. There can be no doubt that it was a milestone in American political life. Interfaith Alliance doesn't endorse candidates or parties in any election. Our focus is fixed on religious freedom and on the implications that any election has for the security of that freedom. It's hard to imagine that yesterday's election won't have some kind of impact on how we approach the issues most central to our mission. To all of those concerned, know this. Over the past 25 years, Interfaith Alliance has defended religious freedom in Washington during Democratic Congresses and Republican ones. Perhaps not since Thomas Jefferson has any single politician or party ever fully embodied our vision of religious freedom in America. And no party is so antagonistic to it that we can't find some common ground. Having said that, we must now be even more vigilant in our defense of the First Amendment's protections of religious freedom than before. A top priority for Interfaith Alliance will be communicating with newly elected members of Congress and asking them to commit themselves to the expansive view of religious freedom for which Interfaith Alliance has advocated since its inception, rather than the narrow sectarian view pushed by the religious right a perspective that paved the way for this year's Hobby Lobby Supreme Court decision. Some of what I've heard from newly elected politicians gives me pause. Actually, it frightens me. Reverend Jody Heiss wrote a book a couple of years ago in which he said that Islam is a political ideology and not a religion, and that Muslims are not entitled to First Amendment protection. In January, this man will be sworn into office as a United States representative from the state of Georgia. Ben Sasse said in an interview last May that he believes that an individual's religious beliefs should allow that person to opt out of nearly any law. Soon, Sasse will be a senator from Nebraska. We must begin the work today of ensuring that the newest class of Washington politicians understands what religious freedom really means. Now, we should be heartened that popular support for marriage equality and LGBT rights has never been higher. Dangerous ballot initiatives that would have imposed religious ideology on women's health care decisions failed across the country. And the energy around undoing the great damage the Supreme Court wrought in its Hobby Lobby decision continues to grow. Yet the politicians elected across the country this past election are unlikely to take up those issues on their own. It's never been more important for the Interfaith Alliance and our supporters like you to be a voice in Washington countering the religious rights distortion of religious freedom and demanding the protection of the First Amendment rights of all Americans. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We make this show very easy to share. Sign up for our podcast at stateofbelief.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And share the stories you find compelling with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure and join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.